tell you about the story of my life.
Let me tell you about the story of my life. My mother was a kitchen girl, and my father was a garden boy. And that's why I'm a freedom fighter. These are the words to Nobody Wants to See Us Together, the South African struggle song that became synonymous with the Fees Must Fall movement, which echoed throughout South African universities and spilled into the country's communities. This particular song was considered special and iconic because it encapsulated the new struggle experienced by South African youth. Today, on the 5-year anniversary of the memorable movement, we will consider the motives behind the movement and how the movement came to be hijacked by politically nefarious entities. Activist Fasia Hassan, one of the hands that ushered in the movement in late 2015, remembers why the University of Witwatersrand's SRC felt a protest was required, and how the hashtag Fees Must Fall movement was born.
So in 2015, I was already elected as a WITS SRC member. I was the academic officer, but I had run a second time, and I was the incoming secretary general of the SRC. So it's not one of those things of where were you? It was, we started Fees Must Fall, you know? So it was on the 14th of October, 2015. This came after failed negotiations with the university for fee increment. You know, we were arguing against it. They were arguing for it. And despite the fact that we had done all this research, and despite the fact that we had effectively concluded that they were asking for too high of an increment, they continued to push forward with it. And that's ultimately about 2 weeks or a week before that, when we sort of started to decide, well, we need to protest. But I must, of course, especially given, you know, where we are, acknowledge the fact that the precursor to this big Fees Must Fall thing was what we call October 6th, which was effectively a workers' movement and fighting for a more dignified experience for workers, but ultimately for insourcing in particular. And all of these things sort of led up to that 14th of October early morning when we decided we were going to protest. And I remember particularly because, you know, you ordinarily protests sort of take on a particular format, right? You sort of sing struggle songs and apartheid songs, you hand over a memorandum, and then you kind of wait for a response. And as the student leadership, we were very clear that that system wasn't going to work. You know, this was something that had been done before, but we needed to effectively try something different. And that's when we started to have discussions about locking the gates. And if you think about it, it's very metaphorical, right? We wanted to find a way in which we could show the university community at the time, this is before it took on national profile, but we wanted to show the university community what this increment would effectively do, as in it would close the doors of higher learning to thousands of poor Black students. And that's when we started playing around with the idea of, you know, quite literally locking the gates, right? Closing those doors so that people could feel inconvenience, people could feel angry. You know, all of those negative feelings that people felt were very much intentional, because we were trying to show society at the time that this wasn't like a faraway thing. You know, this wasn't somebody else dealing with it. This is something you had to feel and go through. So that's kind of, yeah, where I was. We were doing, and there was only 20 of us, even less than in the early hours of that morning on the 14th of October.
Around just 20 students with the best intentions to open up the gates of higher learning to all and dismantle historic disadvantage began a small protest. However, within a couple of weeks, it became a national movement, and within a month or two, it became a place rife with political grandstanding.
I think it was particularly difficult because, you know, especially at the beginning, one wants to believe or give the benefit of the doubt. As in, you know, you're a huge group of students, you have good intentions, but effectively you don't have a lot of social capital, you don't have financial capital, you don't have political capital. Effectively, all you have is the fact that you're a student who might graduate, right? That's kind of your only power. And so when a number of different people across the board took interest, I think we were very welcoming, definitely at the beginning, and even throughout the process. So stuff like when musicians and others came through, I think it was less sinister. But when we started to realize that this was no longer about the fight for free education or around access to higher education, it became a very toxic space. And I think that's not something we reflect on well enough. And it's something that I think we're all still processing. It wasn't an intentional creation of a toxic space, but it became that. Because all of a sudden, if you took platform in a mass meeting and you had a divergent view, or you had a different view to what, you know, this fringe group of people, and, you know, now you can see I'm starting to separate them from the major group, right? Who started to say, well, let's take on a particularly violent role. Let's take on a particularly problematic role, which we disagreed with, right? But if you express divergent views, I mean, you literally had the mic pulled away from you. Yeah, you were yelled at. I mean, I remember Nopendula and Chara being physically pulled off stage. I've been attacked a few times where I was sitting on a chair and they physically picked up that chair and threw me out. And what was shocking about it is that these were not people who were fundamentally involved at the beginning. These were not people who I think had the best interests of students at heart. Half the time, these were not even students, right, who were causing some of these problems. And that's when we began to see that there was far more nefarious intentions, far beyond what we had sort of fought for, right? So we did this mass mobilizing of thousands of people. We have a very genuine cause. But of course, and this is something I've learned, you can never really control thousands of people and push them in one direction just, right? You require planning. You need to have an ideology. You need to have mass buy into that ideology, you know, that conscientization, et cetera, et cetera. And for a long time, I think we did have that, but it definitely waned. And I think it definitely sort of became a ticking time bomb in many ways. And that also caused, effectively what became the hijacking of Fees Must Fall. And even to this day, I think there's still elements when I like look back on it that maybe we shouldn't have allowed. But when you're young, when you're there, you know, you can only work with the information you have in front of you, right? We don't have the benefit of hindsight. We didn't know what was going to happen in the future.
But 5 years on, Fasia does have the benefit of hindsight. She can quite clearly see how the melting pot of a police force notorious for reacting violently to protesters, angry, excluded students, and nefarious entities playing on the emotions and sense of justice of both led to the violent images that South Africans witnessed 5 years ago.
We have a police force that does use heavy-handed approaches, that does tend to react violently. And it's not just in Fees Must Fall protests that we saw it, right? We saw it during Marikana. We see the service delivery protests in townships all the time. You know, we see a heavy-handed police force, right? Then you couple that with students who are genuinely going through the most, right? They genuinely can't afford fees. They're fighting so that they, you know, it's not even about one person. It was never about Fasiha or Yulo, Mtrebo, Shaira, or Biyani. It was never about one person. It was always about fighting for a much bigger thing. But understanding the fact that there were people who were with us side by side who were about to be financially excluded, who are from very poor backgrounds, who didn't have opportunities and chances. Now, you can understand their anger with the system. You can understand the fact that even if you're the smartest person in the room, by virtue of being born poor and being born black, you're not going to have the same opportunities you should have, right? So what you start to see is a melting pot of ingredients that created a situation, you know, that became very difficult. And then you throw on top of all of that people who want to utilize a genuine struggle for their own nefarious agendas. And so in many ways, you had the perfect combination for a crisis, you know.
Fasia says that the hijacking of the protest was not only calculated, but it was aimed at increasing tensions and violence between authorities and students. She shares examples of when this started to become transparent to both her and other members of the movement?
Especially, look, in the first few days of 2016, Visma's fall, and remember, everything I say is from my own experience. I was there. We were initially not violent at all. There was a particular moment that comes to mind where outside the Wits Art Museum in the early days, we were protesting and we sat down on the floor. In fact, I remember we gave this instruction to students. We said, let's all sit down on the floor. Let's put our hands up. They can see we don't have weapons. It will be a peaceful, you know, kind of, inverted commas, I don't always like the word passive resistance, but, you know, inverted commas, passive resistance kind of protest. And the police didn't care. I mean, for like, I have to be honest, they didn't give a fuck. They were like, move. And we're like, no, we're protesting peacefully. We're exercising our constitutional right to protest that. We don't care. If you don't move within the next, like, I don't know, 5 minutes, whatever they said, we're going to shoot. And I remember, because it was so early on in the 2016 protests, that I was like, no, guys, we're sitting on the floor. We are not presenting a risk. That would be an undue use of force. I think we're fine, right? And a lot of us did. A lot of us thought it was okay. We sat down and continued in that way. And then they opened fire, initially with tear gas. And I don't know if you've seen these pictures of Peace Must Fall with the green tear gas. I don't even know what it was exactly. That I remember particularly the green tear gas, and I remember the stun grenades. Because remember, we had instructed people to sit down, and a lot of us were sitting down cross-legged. I remember one girl, when they fired some of the stun grenades, obviously they fired quite a few, but it landed kind of in between her legs and then exploded. And I remember her having like burns on the inside of her thighs and having to take her to hospital. I remember another girl who actually had the side of her face also burned from one of these exploding canisters. Because like I said, we were sitting out on the floor, and you know, it's a matter of a split few seconds. If you don't get up fast enough, and there were so many people, you know, obviously there was no time to really react fast enough. And so her face got burnt. And there were many examples of this. And what you could see already was that the police force, both public order policing, the reaction unit, et cetera, because they descended upon us with every manner of security force you can think of, the K-9 unit. They even had helicopters. I remember because we often used to be at the piazza, you know, the Great Hall stairs. We used to often gather there. And there's only kind of two ways to run, because the police would come on one side. You can't run in the building because it was closed. You either ran one way into Braamfontein, past, you know, the science buildings. Yeah, or you ran down towards the matrix through the fields. And I remember one day we ran through them, or down rather, and the helicopters had, it's difficult to describe. So what was clear that day is that they were targeting a number of us, myself, Catherine, Shaira, Yulo, the women leaders, because we ran in one direction and the others ran in the other. But I remember, because as we were going, because, you know, Wits is quite big, right? And as we were running, we kept bumping into the police. And what one of us eventually figured out, I think it was another student, was that the helicopter had identified us and could obviously see where we were running toward. So the police were already ready and waiting by the time we got to a place where we thought we could hide. And I remember breaking through the back door of what is now the Mutombo building. It's the psychology building. We literally had to break through to get into the building so we weren't arrested. I even remember starting to phone lawyers, right? Because I was like, fuck, this is it. We're all going to get arrested together. Let me start activating lawyers so that when this happens, it's not like, you know, already they can have started processing the paperwork. And that was the day, and this is why it's important, that was the day that the bus was burnt in Braamfontein. And I'm using this particular incident because it's important in terms of the hijacking. So what had happened is quite a few student leaders, we were stuck on campus in this building at Wits. We couldn't get out. Every time we tried to get out, they tear gassed us and shot at us. Meanwhile, shit was kind of going down in Braamfontein. Now, what I'm going to tell you is what journalists on the ground had told me and what other students had told me, because I was not there. But it's important because this was the first big incidents of infiltration and hijacking. There was a bus, not a Wits bus, a public either rear by a Pipco, one of those buses. As students were protesting, the bus driver and everyone abandoned the vehicle and they ran off. Kind of very normal from what I would have expected. Apparently now somebody got into the bus. And this is where journalists are very sure it wasn't a student. Even if I asked students who were there, they were like, it wasn't us. We're very clear. It's not something we do. Got into the bus and drove it into the intersection. So where the bus was abandoned was not in the middle of the intersection at all. It was a few hundred meters back, right? This person drives it into the intersection, gets out of the bus, and then removes something from the engine. I'm not 100% sure because I don't know how buses work, right? But kind of remove something or put something in. It was very strange and very technical. And then that bus burns like huge flames in the intersection, causing major mayhem, chaos.
This is Multimedia Live's own archival audio from the bus burning in Braamfontein. In our own reporting, we stated that it's unclear who is responsible for the bus being set alight.
And we were very angry, actually, because before we heard the story, we were like, what the fuck are you guys doing, right? This is not something we spoke about. This is not tactical, direct action. This is not part of the plan, right? And when we spoke to students in a mass meeting later this afternoon, many students were like, we didn't do that. That doesn't make sense to do. Why would we do that off campus? You know what I mean? There were so many things that didn't add up. And then we verified it. I spoke to a few journalists on the ground, and they said, no, this thing was very dodgy. This didn't look like a student thing because of the technical expertise. And then there were other things, Paige, that started to happen. Like there were explosives that were found not at WITS, at CUT, I think it was, or CPUT, you know, like, and not like homemade stuff, like proper hectic shit that we started to see across the country. So it was clear to us over the next few days that there was quite deliberate infiltration. And the last thing I want to say on this point is that there was a hectic use also of state intelligence. Later, it was admitted to me that our phones were tapped. They were recording our every movement, where we were going, what we were doing, who we were speaking to. And by that point, we were quite used to being followed, especially, I mean, 2016 was hell. I remember being followed home many, many times by unmarked vehicles. I remember my parents getting harassed, my brother getting harassed, my family and other people's families as well. One particular day, we had come from the Heerbrouw police station. Students had been arrested. We were trying to negotiate bail, etc. So we had come back to WITS. There was going to be, I think it was after a mass meeting. We were actually just eating something, right? Just the few of us, sort of FISMA's four leaders, were just kind of grabbing something to eat. We sat in the parking lot. And like I say, by that point, all of us were used to being followed. I think it was a Polo, VW, I don't know exactly, but it was definitely a white hatchback car, had parked in the parking lot way further away from us, but we were used to it. We left it. We didn't have anything to hide. You know, we just continued on. What should have been, I think, a red flag for me and others was that the car left before us, right? And I only noticed that or took note of that now, like, you know, in reflection. So we didn't make anything of it, got back in the car. I was about to drop you off at Reds and a couple, you know, comrades off where they needed to be. And we're driving out of the parking lot at WITS by the Origin Center, right? Driving out. And all of a sudden, we just see like a multitude of police vehicles coming our direction. Now we're coming out of the parking lot, they're coming in. So anyway, we continue on. I'm like, I'm not going to stick around for this. Let's just move on. The next day, it was reported in the newspapers that they had found petrol bombs or explosives in a garbage bin, like a dustbin, very close to where we were sitting. But it became so clear after all of these very strange, very weird happenings that there was like, and I know it sounds weird, right? I don't usually utilize this language, but this idea of a third force, this idea of something that wasn't very clear, but was dodgy and trying to push its own agenda, was 100% there. And anyone who tells you it wasn't, I think was not on the ground or was not, or could not clearly see what was going on, because what was a genuine student struggle was definitely being hijacked by that point.
Who or why, we can't tell you. But by the time students began to realize that outside entities were infiltrating their movement with the hopes of escalating violence, Movements around the country made it clear that politicians looking to grandstand or speak on behalf of their respective parties would not be tolerated.
Comrades, as we are gathered here, we don't represent any political party. We represent black pain.
But in many respects, the tension between authorities and protesters had already mounted by that stage. And most students who took part in the Fees Must Fall protest will be able to pull out a defining memory of when their life was altered permanently. This is Fasias.
And I remember we had discussed creating and forming a human chain. We sort of lock arms. We're like, okay, let's do this. And first we sat on the floor and we created just a chain, like a human chain. And the Casper's like kind of driving toward us. We don't move. But it's kind of aggressive, you know, it's moving closer and closer. And now we're like, okay, maybe we should stand up. We're not going to do anything. We're just going to stand up, continue locking arms, but at least we'll be standing. So if shit hits the fan, we can run, right? We stand up. And at this point, I remember very particularly the Casper, where I was standing, I was half of my body was in the way and the other half was, you know, the end part. I don't know how to describe this. Like half of my body was, the Casper was about to run over and the other half was a little bit out. And I saw there a police officer, you know, they have those windows doors where they can just pull the gun out, you know, so they are protected, pointing the gun at me. I mean, less than a meter, like a meter is even far, because by this point they were about to run us over and we're like, no, they can't run us over. We're really not doing anything. Let's just continue holding on. And in that moment, I think I did genuinely experience, but like not a horror movie kind of fear. Like, this is it. If this guy shoots, that's it. There's less than a meter between us. It's over. If they run us over, that's also it, because we'll all get crushed. And a lot of people don't know this about me, but I'm actually a deeply spiritual person. I'm a practicing Muslim. And there's a particular prayer that we read when, you know, when you're feeling unsafe, you know, when you're particularly at risk. And I remember saying, okay, well, this might be the moment, right? Let me read this thing to myself.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Allahu la ilaha illa huwa al-hayyul qayyum.
And I know this sounds so weird. Like, I know even if I heard it from someone else, I don't know if I believe it, but it happened. So, you know, it's there. But something was just like, something caught my attention, you know, to look away, to look to the right hand side. And there was nothing there, but like I looked there. And in that moment in which I turned my head, they had poured what was a liquid. It was like pepper spray, but a liquid. I have no idea what the actual thing was, but it was like, it felt like pepper spray because it burned everyone's eyes, but it was a liquid. And that's how they broke the chain. But it didn't hit me in the eyes. It just like hit my clothing, right? Because I had turned. And that, in that moment, even though it was just a few seconds, everything I've described to you happened probably within a 2-minute period, even though it felt much longer. It really tested who I am. It tested my leadership. It tested my feminism. It tested my faith. It tested everything. You know, I could have run away, I could have let it go, I could have said this is not worth it. You know, there were all of these things that go through your mind, right, when you're facing it. And I'm really proud to say that I didn't, but it was definitely a moment in which every fiber of my being was tested. I'll never forget that moment. If anything, it you know, when you think of moments that changed who you are, or moments that carved out the person that you are today, that's one of those moments.
But despite the best efforts of students, higher education in South Africa is still dear. 5 years on, a lot of students wonder to themselves, was it worth it? For Fasia, there's no doubt. It was definitely worth the fight.
The topic and discussion of free education or access to education, especially higher education, is a dinner table topic, whereas before it wasn't, right? People just thought, oh, you go to university, you get a scholarship, that's it, right? And it took that entire movement to show that that's not enough. But more importantly, that this is something where young people, and this is the most important part of all of it, young people post-apartheid saying, we respect what you have fought for, the old guard. We understand it. We respect the liberation movement. But that doesn't mean that we are done fighting. And it doesn't mean that we have an equal society. And us trying to create an equal society doesn't make us bad people, right? That there's a much bigger generational battle we have to fight here. Whether it's only about education, I don't think so. I think it's beyond that. But we have, in many ways, galvanized young people to be more aware politically and otherwise. So now, you know, you see it all the time, and often I reflect on this. It's cool to be woke. It was never cool to be woke before. But now when I look at other young people, when I look at like family members, when I look and I do talks at other schools, I mean, I went to Parktown Girls, not as high school, but I went there to do a talk like a year ago. And this 16-year-old young girl introduces, hi, I'm so-and-so. I'm an intersectional feminist. And I was like, God, I wish at 16 I could have known what intersectional feminism was, you know, being politically correct, doing the right thing, whether it's around the environment and climate justice, or whether it's around gender-based violence or Black Lives Matter, or whatever the case is, you're seeing young people who I think are becoming less apathetic. Obviously, there's a whole group of people who don't care, obviously, right? But I'm grateful for the fact that there are young people who are proud to be woke and proud to be conscious and who want to do something about the current status quo. So if nothing else, I take that as a very big victory, you know, that we have young people who really, really want to change the world. And I think we also showed them that unintentionally or intentionally, we showed them that there's something that we can do, right? We don't just have to fold our arms and allow the old guard to make decisions for us and think nothing's going to change. And given the rise of right-wing politics with Trump and Bolsonaro and Boris Johnson and all these things, it's more important now than ever. Beyond Fees Must Fall, beyond South Africa, you know, there's a fight for the world, I guess. And I'm just happy that, you know, there's something beyond it and that young people in South Africa could be a part of that.
Argentina, Austria, Brazil, the Czech Republic, Denmark, Egypt, Finland, France, Germany, Greece, Iceland, Kenya, Luxembourg, Malaysia, Morocco, Norway, Panama, Poland, Slovenia, Spain, Sweden, Turkey, the United Kingdom, and Uruguay all offer free college tuition to their citizens in 2020, according to the World Population Review. South Africa is still not on this list, but perhaps, as Fasia suggests, students who took part in the hashtag Fees Must Fall protest can find value in having made systematic inequality a household topic. For Multimedia Live, I am Paige Muller.